Hello and good morning to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and today we are going to be continuing looking at the book of Genesis. I told all of you we kind of had some things that came up. We had to get away from the podcast for a while, but we're starting, starting to go ahead and get everything caught back up, making sure we get everybody back to where we were initially when we had to kind of walk away for a little bit. Today, we're going to be doing something, though, a little bit different than what we normally do. We've had this come up a couple of times, but in this particular instance, it's going to be because the story, the full frame of what is going to occur, happens in both Genesis chapter 33 and 34. Because as you saw last week, we got into Genesis chapter 32. We see that Jacob has no faith in God whatsoever. He tries to prepare for this situation to deal with his brother Esau in his own way, in his own method. And, of course, that doesn't work. And Esau starts coming with 400 men to meet him. And Jacob goes, oh, no, we're going to die. And he starts to try to plan out. He divides his entire group of followers, servants, wealth into two different groups, you know, so if one gets attacked, the other can get away. He starts to get all of these things, and then in the middle of the night, he gets up, there's conviction, there's thoughts on his mind, he's staring at the ceiling, those kind of nights. I'm sure all of you have experienced that at some point, I know I have. And he decides then that he's going to move everybody across the river. All right, he has the faith, you know, we're going to have to meet this head on, we're going to have to challenge this, moves everyone across the river, and he stays by himself on the other side, and God literally wrestles with him there, right? And we talked about how God sometimes has to break a few hip joints, for lack of a better way of putting it, meaning that God didn't overpower Jacob on purpose. He allowed Jacob to feel like he was going to win, that he could stand, that all of that self-reliance that Jacob had had that has led to these poor, poor, horrible, awful, faithless decisions. God says, you know what? You go right ahead. Let's see how well you can take care of yourself. And finally, as the sun is starting to come up, Jacob has wrestled with God literally all night long. God says, all right, we're done. Touches his thigh, pops this joint out of place, right? Gives him a permanent limp. And many people look at this and they go, oh, what kind of a terrible, awful God would do these things. But reality is that God is putting Jacob in a place where Jacob has to trust in him. Many, many people come to the Bible with this misconception that when God, you know, allows people to die, or God, you know, pops a joint out of place, that God is some big, horrible, awful bully. But in fact, God is doing something, he is fixing something that's going to make you a better person in the long run. Jacob's self-reliance, Jacob's lack of faith is actually something that's going to continue. Even though he's wrestled with God, he's still a human. And this has always been his biggest sin problem. He's a deceiver. He does things his way. He gets himself out of his own problems. That's kind of what his idea is, and I'm sure many of us all have this issue too, that we believe we are able to handle a situation. And what's awesome is that you have chapter 32, where everybody goes, how cruel of God. Jacob has this permanent limp now, you know, all because God wanted to prove a point. But the lesson that God was trying to get Jacob to understand on that side of the river is a lesson that if he had learned it and trusted in God, would not have led to what happens in Genesis chapter 33 and Genesis chapter 34. Many, many times we read the Bible one-sided. We look at a particular instance and we just decide that all of a sudden, oh, we know this is who God is in relation because we've separated this group of verses from its context. Now, even this morning as I was eating my breakfast, drinking my coffee, this kind of thing, I tell everybody at the church that I pastor that one of my biggest priorities as a pastor, which what I believe is the actual job of a pastor. There's good Christian things to do. There's what our actual duty is to be people who know the Bible. That's the whole point of this podcast. In fact, today, what I listened to this morning is actually going to change the whole frame of this podcast. We've done a whole overview of the Bible. We were going to go, you know, book by book, verse by verse. But we're going to take a break from that when we get to the end of Genesis to talk about the big questions, the big things that are going on in our world right now that God's people should already know the answers to, but they don't. Okay? But get back to the initial topic. As I was eating my breakfast, drinking my coffee, I was listening to a debate between an agnostic and he's a Christian individual, but he's not a pastor or anything like that. He's more of a political person than anything else. And they were talking about trying to, how is it that you have, it's called theodicy, and I didn't really use that word. I don't like, as you guys know from being on here, I don't like to use big terms because big terms, in my opinion, breed arrogance. They're not trying to tell you anything of importance. They're just trying to show you, look what I know. But what that big fancy term means is, how do we have an almighty, omnipotent God that bad things happen, people suffer? Okay? It's an age-old question. It's a question that everybody asks, question that everybody tries to, in a way, put in a box, and you can't do that when you're talking about God. And what kept coming about was this idea that God is a big, mean bully. God is a big, mean bully. This actual instance came up at a point in this particular debate of, you know, well, I mean, God just popped his joint out of place and said, ta-da, I win. But what we're doing when we do this is we're not looking at the full picture, okay? If, for example, if you came into the room and I was getting on to my child, okay, and you can picture that however you want to, putting them in a corner, spanking their hind end, whatever, okay? Particularly for me, if she's being bad enough, I may be having a conversation with her. It may be I am going to spank your bottom conversation, or I may have spanked her bottom, okay? You come into the room, you hear this, and you just come in and you just see that I've spanked her bottom. If you look at just that instance, I'm being a cruel individual. But if you had been in the room earlier when she slapped me in the face, or she said something horrible to her mother, or she broke something important, or she did something for the fourth time she wasn't supposed to do, there's a difference in the narrative when you know what happened before. And many times we judge God and God's decisions and what God does off of just what the action that we see, not the full picture that comes into play. So in 32, we see God is teaching him, rely on me. And we think we finally see Jacob. He's finally figured it out, right? Because he grabs onto God's ankles and he says, I'm not letting you go until you bless me. We're going, yes, Jacob, you figured this out. But he hasn't figured out the lesson entirely. Because what happens today was the reason for the lesson. God does things in our lives to try to prepare us, to try to help us to make better decisions, to try to get us in a position where we trust him and we do what is right because of what it may lead to in our lives if we do not do it. And so with that said, let's look at chapter 33 and 34. Okay? So Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. So last time we saw Jacob, he crossed the river, he's leading his family towards Esau, he's preparing for this moment, okay? And he divided the children unto Leah, and unto Rachel, and unto the two handmaids, and he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. So, here he does the exact same thing, okay? He's leading the group, but he still doesn't trust Esau, he thinks Esau's going to kill him. So he puts the least important people in the front and kind of works himself back to the people he loves the most, which is horrible, and is going to be what leads to all of the family problems in Jacob's family, is this favoritism clearly displayed here. But we'll get into that as we further, you know, get into the story of Jacob and his children, okay? It says, "And he passed over before them, and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." So Jacob, sees Esau coming. He kind of starts shuffling his family from least important to most important, further away from the threat, okay? As they approach, he bows 7 times to Esau, which is, it's an act of humility. It's something you would have done if you saw a lord or a noble approaching. And as he is bowing this final time, Esau jumps off of his, you know, camel, horse, whatever, all right? Runs to Jacob, grabs him, and they weep. And many people look at this and they go, huh, because there's no conversation of, I'm sorry, you're sorry, I was a terrible brother, you know, let's move on. This is the moment of reconciliation. What's beautiful about this is that God already knew Esau's heart. God already knew that this was going to be what would take place, what would conspire. The thing that Jacob was so afraid of and wasn't willing to trust God about was literally never in the realm of possibility. As God was teaching Jacob, trust in me. Stop worrying, stop using your brain, stop trying to figure things out your way, trust me. God already knew that Esau was ready to reconcile with Jacob. And what makes this picture so powerful is that Jacob's bowing, fully expecting Esau to try to kill him, and instead his brother runs to him, grabs him, and in that moment, there are no words that have to be shared. They have forgiven each other. Over this 20 years, they have both moved on from what happened. And it's beautiful because there's so many times in our life where we fight God and we fight God and we fight God, and God's got to come down and he's got to wrestle with us and he's got to pop a few joints, as I said. We go against God and we, no. I know that this is what's going to happen because of my history, my experience, blah, 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 has proven this to be so. And the whole time, God already knows we're wrong. In this moment, this was Jacob's time to go, oh, how foolish was I. If I had trusted God, there never would have been a need to have all of this drama. There never would have been a need for me to be concerned, because God had already worked it out. The problem was already handled. And in this moment, a lot of people will focus on, you know, that a lot of pastors will focus on forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. And I don't disagree with that at all. I think you see a story of forgiveness here that's very amazing, really. These two brothers that, you know, God has worked on them over the last 20 years. They've grown up, for lack of a better way of putting it. And they can immediately put this behind them. But that's not the focus of what happens here. What happens here is God has just proven to Jacob, this is why you should trust me. But look at what Jacob does. It says, and he lifted up his eyes, so this is Esau, and saw the women and the children, and said, who are these with thee? And he said, the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. Then the handmaidens came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near and bowed themselves. And after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. And he said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. And Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself. And Jacob said, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and he took it. So Esau comes, hugs Jacob's neck, right? They weep, they cry, they have their guy moment, all right? You're forgiven, I'm forgiven. And he looks up and he says, well, who's this? He knows who it is. You know, he knows that it's Jacob's family, but he wants to know who they are. Just like anybody else, if you hadn't seen your family member in a long time and you've gotten married, you've had a kid since you last saw them, that's the question. Who is this? And so he introduces all of them, but notice how he is speaking to Esau, which God hath graciously given thy servant. He is still talking to Esau like Esau's going to hurt him. When Esau says, what's with all the animals? He goes, oh, that's a present that I, your servant, have sent to you. God has given to me graciously. I ask that you will look upon me favorably. He's not talking to Esau the way a brother would speak to Esau. He's not talking to Esau the way a fellow sibling would have spoken to Esau. I don't see my sisters and go, oh, I am your servant. Here is a present. These are not normal interactions that are occurring here. You go, well, wait. You know, they had a weird culture. They talked. They did. But this is not a normal proceeding between two brothers. Esau is a simple man, okay? Jacob knows Esau is a simple man. Esau is not conniving. He's not manipulative. He's not deceptive. He is basically a hammer looking for a nail. All right? That's who Esau is. If Esau had wanted to kill Jacob, he would have killed Jacob at the beginning. That's who he is. Esau is genuinely over the past. He has forgiven Jacob. Jacob has forgiven him. They've had this moment. But Jacob still does not trust God enough to believe that his brother is different. To believe that his brother is genuine. He's still walking on eggshells. Oh, this is the family God has graciously given your servant. Oh, I ask that you take all of that present. I want to make sure that I find favor in your sight. He is still trying to do things Jacob's way. Now, I've seen many people get up and go, oh, you know, Jacob here, you know, he's doing the right thing. He's showing humility because, you know, he made a mistake. They both did. Esau was just as much in the wrong as Jacob was in the wrong, as Isaac was in the wrong, as Rachel was in the wrong. What this is that Jacob still does not trust God fully. You go, well, now, Pastor Zach, how in the world could he wrestle with God all night? He had that moment with God and still not have faith. I don't know. You got saved and you have salvation and you believe that God is going to eternally take you into heaven, and how many times do you still not trust God to handle your day today? Quite a bit, I'm sure. Jacob had had this moment, and Jacob is starting to become Israel. He's starting to become, or Israel, as you would say in English, okay? He's starting to become that person, but right now he's still Jacob. There's a long way to go. And he does not trust Esau at all. In fact, he trusts Esau so little, he has so little faith, that God will handle anything that would happen to him, even if it's at the hand of Esau, that look at what happens here. It says, my Lord knoweth that... Oh, excuse me. he looks at Esau, I had seen the face of God, and thou was pleased with me. Take, I pray thee. And he urged him, and he took it. And verse 12, he says, and he said, let us take our journey, and let us go. And I will go before thee. Esau, again, very simple man. Met everybody. He's accepted the present. Okay, fine, I'll take the animals. He goes, well, come on, let's head home. That's where you're headed, right? We're headed that way too. We'll go before you, meaning we'll move in front of you so that we're not pushing your group too quickly. And he could fight off any potential threats. He's got an army of 400 men. And Jacob said unto him, my Lord knoweth that the children are tender, and the flocks and herds with young are with me. And if men should overdrive them one day, all the flock will die. Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant, and I will lead on softly, according as the cattle that goeth before me, and the children be able to endure, until I come unto my Lord, unto Seir. And Jacob answers him, and he goes, Oh, Esau, my brother, you know, the children, you know, they're fragile. They don't travel as quickly, and, you know, but our flocks back here, we've had a big old group of new births amongst the flock, and, you know, if we push them hard, even one day we push them too hard, they all would drop dead. So you just go on it. I will slow you down. You just go on ahead. We'll move at our pace. You just take off full throttle, and I'll see you when I get there. Okay? Sounds all right, doesn't it? You know, there's been times that you've told your, oh, well, you know, come on, you follow me, or I'll follow you. And we'll get there. Excuse me. Goodness. Now, we'll get there together. And that, oh, we just slow you down. Y'all just go. We'll catch up with you in a little bit. Okay? That's what Jacob says. And look at what Esau says. It says, and Esau said, well, let me now leave with thee some of the folk that are with me. Esau goes, well, okay, you know, I understand that, brother, but we're in Canaan, and this is some dangerous land. I tell you what, I'll leave some of my soldiers with you, and, some of my men, my servants, whatever, and I'll leave them here, and they'll make sure to protect you, and then I'll see you when you get there. And look at what Jacob says. Well, oh, what needeth it? Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord. Jacob looks at Esau and goes, that's not necessary, is it? No. Let me find grace in your sight. I don't want to cause you any kind of trouble or problem. Okay, brother, I've been traveling all the way here, just us. No problems, no issues, nothing bad's happened. And that would just cause you, you know, a tremendous headache. You go on ahead. You take your men and you go. Now, why is it that you think that Jacob is so adamantly against traveling with Esau, keeping any of Esau's men as protection? Why would he be so adamantly against that? A lot of people don't really ask this question sometimes. They, oh, he's just, you know, it's he's just being, trying to be kind. He's trying to be hospitable. He's trying to not be a burden. That's not it at all. At all. Because look at what happens. It says, so Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir. Seir is south of where we are. Alright, I'm going to help you out with that. He is south. We are here in this particular, near this particular river. Seir is south of our location. Okay? So Esau goes, all right, brother. Again, not manipulative, not deceptive. He is a hammer looking for a nail. Not telling you that he's a good guy, because he's not. We know that his tribe ends up being a huge problem for Israel. And he doesn't really care all that much about spiritual things or about God. But as far as being some masterminded evil genius, that's not Esau. Esau is very, very plain. He's basically your typical brutish male, okay? He's just big, dumb, and tone deaf. There's not really much else you can do for Esau. He says, okay, sounds good to me. Starts heading to Seir, and it says, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, which is north of where we are located. Jacob had so little faith in God. He had so little faith in the fact that God could protect him, that even though he meets his brother and they have this moment of forgiveness, Esau, he knows who Esau is. He knows that if Esau wanted to beat him black and blue, Esau would have beat him black and blue right then and there. Esau has no reason to be pretending or to lure Jacob. Jacob is giving Esau the attributes of who Jacob is and what Jacob would do to people. He has so little faith in God that he lies to the brother that he's supposedly just made up with. Okay? He has so little faith in God that he not only lies to him about, well, I, you know, oh yeah, I'll see you down there, but that he lies to him about where he's going to be living. And instead of going south towards Seir to Bethel, which is where God called him to go, some people argue about whether or not God meant that literally or not. Doesn't matter. Either way, God called him to go back to his home. Alright, whether God intended for his home to be Bethel or he intended for it to be back down near Seir, doesn't matter. God called him to go further into the land, to the center of the land. And instead, to avoid his brother, because he has so little faith that God can protect him, even though his answer, his reason for having faith in God should have been the fact that his brother and him had just gotten over a 20-year spat. He lies and goes north to Succoth, near a city where evil men and evil idolatry is near. Just like Lot did when Abraham and Lot came into the land, and Lot chose to go dwell near Sodom and Gomorrah. He comes and he moves towards Succoth, and then he does something else that God told them not to do. It says, and build him a house. This is not the idea of a house in what you and I would think, but it is a particular type of tent that's not something you just move. Okay? It's not a tent like what he's been traveling in up to this point. It is a much more permanent home. And God told them, do not build a permanent home in the land. You're going to dwell in the land. You're going to go back and forth in the land. Jacob here, he's, again, he wants to be established. He wants to have security. He does not want to just trust in God and where God leads him. So something many of us still do today. Not saying you need to sell your house, that's okay. Yeah, it's all right for you to have a house. But God's people, we are not meant to be ones who we establish and gain securities for ourselves here in this world. We are supposed to be people that are flexible and are willing to do the work of God and the will of God. No matter what that entails or what that means. And so here he's building a house. He makes booths for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Alright, that's where he moves near to. Okay? And that means booths. He moves north and he establishes this area. And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem. Alright, he has pitched his tent in Succoth near this city. Succoth being the name of his compound, basically. Near this city, Shalem, which was a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. He lives very nearby to a city of idolatrous Gentiles. And he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it El Olehe Israel. All right? Which means God, the God of Israel. Okay? So here, this sets the stage for chapter 34. And the reason that we're putting these chapters together is because at the beginning of chapter 33, like God does in our lives, here's the proof, Jacob, that you need to trust and have faith in me. That you need to rely on me. The proof is that you thought Esau's going to kill you, but guess what? I knew that Esau was ready to mend your relationship. Jacob, you should trust me. But Jacob's lack of faith, he chooses to not trust God. He chooses to disobey what God had told him to do. He tries to put as much distance as he can between him and his brother, and in doing so, he has placed himself next to a greater evil, which is the idolatrous Canaanite city of Shalem. And it is, in fact, Hamor and Shechem, who he buys this land from for him to pitch his tent before the city, that are going to cause a great evil to come on his family. And in 34, we see that A lack of faith, the lesson that we learn here from 33 into 34, is that having this lack of faith, especially when God has already proven in our lives that we should have faith, always leads to horrible tragedies. Always leads to the suffering that the men I told you about earlier were debating this morning. Look at what happens to Jacob's only daughter. It says, and Dinah, some say Dinah, doesn't matter, pronounce it however you'd like, we all get what you're saying. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, okay? And then for some, I know there were a few on here that were like, well, how do you literally pronounce the name? It's Dinah, is how you would say the name in Hebrew, okay? It's Dinah. Some say Dinah, some say Dinah, I don't care. You can say it however you want to. I get it, we all get it. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. So what ends up happening here is we have this only daughter, Dinah, 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 whatever. Okay? And she, like most girls, wants to go make friends. Okay? Every child wants to have friends. Okay? Now, when I was being raised, I had an interesting mother. My mother essentially said, the only thing you need in this world is God. The last thing you need to be worried about is making friends, okay? But for many other people outside of me, friends are a part of natural growth, okay? And so she goes out and she wants to see the daughters of the land, meaning she wants to go make friends with the people and the girls in the city next door. Jacob should have thought about this already, right? Because here he has sons and he has daughters. And they're going to form friendships. They're going to form relationships. They're eventually going to want to do this this horrible, awful thing that parents have to go through, which is called marriage. where they want to marry somebody. Who has he placed them near to form these relationships with due to his lack of faith? Next to idolatrous Gentiles. Idolatrous Gentiles that do not adhere to the authority of an almighty moral God. And so, as a result of that, she goes out to make friends with these girls, and she runs into the men of the city of Shalem as well. It says, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her, and defiled her. You go, whoa, what just happened? Yes, what you just saw is she went out to go make friends. She went to the city. She was not accompanied by a brother or her father. And as a result of that, this young man, who is the son of the guy who essentially established the city, Hamor, he says, she's pretty. I want her. He takes her. And he rapes her. You go, well, no, Pastor Zach, these kinds of things just don't happen now. They're happening right now in Afghanistan. As we're doing this recording, the Taliban have taken over Afghanistan again. What happens to a woman in those countries, under those people, under that religious, idolatrous, awful law, is that a woman that is unaccompanied is essentially free for whatever they want to do. That's the same thing that happens here. Shechem says, Dad's not around. Brothers aren't around. I'd really like to know how that would be. Takes her and rapes her. And then something very fascinating happens that people try to justify this sometimes with. It says, and his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. And he loved the damsel, and spake kindly unto the damsel. So Shechem takes her, okay? He rapes her. And then it says that his soul clave unto her. Now, many people look at this, and sometimes even pastors, horribly enough, and go, you know, yeah, there's this horrible mistake, and he raped her. But after he'd raped her, he actually loved her. That's not what happens here. What happens here is the reason that sexual relationships are limited to marriage and marriage only And what I mean by that is that God is not an idiot. Many people look at monogamy and they go, oh, that's so dumb. We can have various relationships with whoever we want to have, blah, 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 blah. That is not true. Humanity is designed for a monogamous relationship. Even if you don't want to call that marriage, okay? You just want to call that who you have sexual relations with. We are designed for a one-person relationship. And the reason for that is this. When you have marriage, you have two individuals, okay, who are making a vow before God that they are going to stay with this person all of their life, okay? And what that means is that you love that person for who they are. You're not marrying them for what you're going to get physically after the marriage vow. You are marrying them because of who they are and their compatibility to your life. Which means anyone you marry, you have to marry someone who you have the same foundational goals. All right? When my wife and I got married, the first foundational goal we had to have was that we had to believe the same. If I didn't believe in God, but she believed in God, that's going to lead to strife in the marriage. Because with marriage comes things like children and extended families, things of this nature, that you're going to have an extraordinarily complex and very, very, very unfounded home if both parties do not believe in the same things. We had to believe the same about how we were going to discipline children. We had to believe the same in how we were going to handle family affairs. We had to believe the same in how we were going to handle financial affairs. We have to grow together and take our lives and make them one. That's what marriage is. But we have this thing called consummating the marriage, which means that after you have made this vow before God and you are married, you may now partake in the privileges that come with that marriage, which is the sexual relationship, okay? Many people don't understand that the reason a marriage could be broken off if a consummation had not occurred is because consummation is what ties the individuals physically. You have a spiritual tie by making the vow before God. But there's also a physical tie that comes when you have that relationship. Many, many people, even people who have broken, who have had fornication or adulterous relationships outside of marriage, who have had multiple partners, will all tell you that there is a particular part, a particular remembrance of that first person. Because when you have given yourself in that manner, when you have a sexual relationship with your spouse, you are unveiling everything about you. There is nothing that person does not know about you now. You are at your most intimate in that particular moment, your most vulnerable. There is now no secrets between the two of you on a physical level. That's what happens here. His soul cleaving to her is that physical bond has been established. He liked what he received from his act of rape, and now he wants to keep her. The idea of love is that he has a physical desire for her. Just like any, it's no different than when one of my chickens finds his favorite hen out here in the back. That is the extent of how he feels about her. Shechem, if he loved her, he would not have raped her. It was after the rape that he said, you know, actually, I really liked what we have together, and I think I'd like to keep you. That's the extent of what happens. Jacob's lack of faith that drives him as far away from his brother as he can, that drives him away from where God says he's supposed to be, places him and his family in a position that is much, much worse than if he had trusted God and let God deal with Esau and his family. So much so worse that it leads to the raping of his daughter. And now we have this problem because not only has the man raped and defiled his daughter, but this man also has now decided he'd like to keep his prize. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this damsel to wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. So Shechem goes to his dad and says, "Can you get me this new bike?" That's essentially what he says. He goes, "Dad, I really like her. That was lots of good stuff that happened there. So can you go and just find out what the asking price is on this particular model?" That's literally what he does. And Jacob does something that is absolutely astounding. I am a father. I have a daughter. She is 19 months old. Okay? And one of the things that my wife and I talk about every now and again is that someday this daughter that I have is going to grow up into a woman. And I'm going to have to deal with this, you know, topic of watching over, of educating her, of making sure that she knows what to look for in a man and a spouse. You know, all the boy stuff, all right? That's what they call it. If I had been told, if I had known that my daughter had been at school and, you know, had been, you know, wherever in a public place, and a young man had taken physical advantage of her, I seriously doubt that I would have, quote-unquote, held my peace. Okay? Jacob has no reaction. He hears what's happened. He's waiting on his sons to come home with the cattle, and he just sits. I would have went and hunted the dude down, and we would have had an understanding. All right? Jacob here not only has no faith in God, but Jacob is complacent in what has occurred, mostly because of his fear. Jacob's biggest thing is that if he can't trick his way out of it, he just takes it. And so here, it says, and he holds his peace, he waits on his sons to come. Okay? It says, and Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. So Jacob's holding his peace. Hamor says, "All right, let me go talk, find out what she's worth. I cannot believe you didn't ask the price before you tried the car," is literally what the attitude of this situation is. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. Jacob, he just kind of, let's see what we can do about this situation now. Jacob's sons, this is wrong, this is terrible, this is awful what these people have done. They deserve justice for what they have done. They're the only one showing any real emotion in this situation. It should have said, and Jacob was very wroth and very grieved because this should never have happened to his daughter. But instead, it is his sons that are angry, that want something to be done. And so they, too, go to the party to hear what's going to happen. All right? And Hamor communed with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you, give her him to wife, and make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you, and ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get your possessions therein. Hamor goes to Jacob and says, it does not address the fact that his son has raped Jacob's daughter, and basically says, look, my kid likes your kid. Why don't, you know, and we've kind of had this bad foot going forward. Why don't you just let these two marry? And you know what? It's a crazy idea, but I think it'll work. We'll give you our daughters. You give us your daughters. Let's just tie the knot here between us and your family. You go, now why in the world does he want to do this? Because Jacob is extravagantly wealthy. You're going to find that out here in just a moment, okay? What their motivation is. He's not addressing the rape because in his mind that there was nothing wrong in what occurred there. His son saw what he wanted, he took it. You know, things happen. But if we want to make sure that everybody's happy and that everybody feels good about this situation, you know, let's just tie the bonds. And even better than that is, you know, once we're all intermarried here, you can be part of our group, we'll be a part of your group. You can come do trade with us, we'll do trade with you. Everybody goes home happy. All right? And Shechem said unto her father and unto her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes, and what ye shall say unto me, I will give. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, I will give according as ye shall say unto me. But give me the damsel to wife. And Shechem, seeing that what dad's saying isn't really working out, he goes, look here, fellas, okay? I'm willing to pay. That's not a problem. Name your price and I'll give it to you. Just let me marry her. Okay? It says, and the sons of Jacob answered. Shechem and Hamor give this horrible, awful, please let us buy the cow now comment, completely based in what they can get out of being married into the family of Jacob. And before Jacob can answer, that lack of faith Jacob had, that self-reliance that Jacob has, that compromising that Jacob has done, is going to come to fruition, because before he can answer, his sons cut him off. Meaning they just dishonored Jacob by not letting Jacob deal with this situation. But the reason they're not letting Jacob deal with this situation is because they don't think Jacob's going to actually do anything. Because Jacob historically has never done anything. Jacob historically has compromised on everything. Jacob has preached, serve the God of Israel, while not even having enough faith to serve the God of Israel. And so his sons say, no, you don't get to make this call. Jacob's lack of trust in God comes full circle here in his sons. And his sons, the sons of Jacob, answered Shechem and Hamor his father deceitfully. Not only are they cutting dad out of the equation, but they are answering just like dad would answer. The sons of Jacob are truly the products of Jacob's sin. They answered deceitfully and said, because he hath defiled Dinah, or their sister, Dinah, their sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised. For that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if ye will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then we will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if ye will not hearken unto us, to be circumcised, then will we take our daughter, and we will be gone. and their words pleased Hamor. Sons answer, and they got a plan up their sleeve, and they say, okay, look, 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 look. We don't have a problem with you wanting to buy the car. Alright, we can work that out. But the problem we actually have is a spiritual problem. You guys are uncircumcised idolatrous Gentiles, and we are circumcised followers of God. So if you, all of the men in your city, will agree to a circumcision, then we'll let you marry her, and we'll give you our daughters, and you can give us yours. And Hamor loves this, and the reason Hamor loves this is because it's not costing Hamor any money. He is getting the cow for free as long as he undergoes this minor, you know, it's not going to be fun, it's going to be painful, but this very minor procedure, and boom, he has access to the wealth of Israel, he has access to the women of Israel, and this is going to make his city stronger. So he's happy with it. And you see this. It says in Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man deferred not to do the thing because he had delight in Jacob's daughter. And he was more honorable than all the house of his father. So Hamor, at this point, he's pleased because this means dollar signs. Shechem is pleased because while he's motivated physically, he has more honor than his father because he actually wants the daughter of Jacob. Not for the right reasons, but he actually wants to marry her, all right? Which is why the Bible says he was more honorable than all of his father's house. His father is trying to manipulate his way into money, into getting what he wants. Shechem genuinely wants to go ahead and marry Dinah. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came unto the gate of their city, and communed with the men of their city, saying, for these men are peaceable with us. Therefore let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters for us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised, as they are circumcised. Shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. So Hamor and Shechem call all the men together, and they go, all right, guys, look, here's the deal. If we all get this little procedure done, then we can have their daughters and their daughters. And at some point in them giving this little demonstration, you hear this tone shift, right? Where they start defending the reason that they're bringing this up. And I'm sure it's because all the men went, oh, no, 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 no. We are not doing this just so Shechem can have his new car. That's essentially what this whole argument is. This young woman, who should have been able to be married to a good, righteous, godly man and live a good, godly, and have a good, godly, righteous family, because her father's lack of faith, has now been raped and is essentially being treated by all parties involved as nothing more than getting a new cow, getting a new car, getting a new piece of property. And so Hamor and his son go, hold on, hold on. I know you all look at it just this way, but think about this, men. If we do this, all the wealth that Jacob has, it's going to be at our disposal too. This is going to make everything better for everybody. So this isn't just about Shechem. This is also about the dollar signs. And when he says that, look at what happens. It says, and unto Hamor and unto Shechem his son hearkened all that went out of the gate of his city. And every male was circumcised. They go, oh, wait a minute. Okay, there's money in it for all of us. If he gets to have this chick, all right, let's do it. And everyone is circumcised, and all that went out of the gate of this city, and it came to pass on the third day. All right? This is very interesting, proven scientific fact. Obviously, circumcision is the removing of the foreskin of a male. Okay? During this time, of course, there's not any anesthetics, not any pain relievers, numbers, any of those things. The third day after a circumcision is the most painful, and it actually can incapacitate a male, meaning they cannot get up, they cannot walk, they are in such miserable, awful, terrible pain that they're powerless. So the sons of Jacob knew the whole time that they told these guys, we want you to get circumcised, that the plan was they were going to kill them all because they were not going to be able to fight back on the third day after their circumcision. Jacob's lack of faith takes him outside of the will of God, results in the raping of his daughter. Jacob's lack of faith and compromising life leads to a lack of trust of the sons and their father to handle this situation. And so they use the same self-reliance that they have seen their father use to plot the mass murdering of hundreds of men. It says that it came to pass on the third day when they were sore that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep and their oxen and their asses and that which was in the city, and that which was in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives, took they captive, and spoiled even all that was in the house. Jacob's two sons, Levi and Simeon, they had already gotten the plan together, what they were going to do. They go in on the third day, they kill all the men, they take all of their wealth, all of their animals, and they enslave their children and their wives. Many people read this and they go, now, well, you know, Pastor Zach, though, these guys were just as evil as Hamor and Shechem. Yes, but these men were not responsible for what happened to Dinah. Them murdering all of the men of the town was vengeance. It was not justice. Jacob's lack of faith and compromising life, even though God proved to him in chapter 33, you can't trust me. What he thought was going to happen with Esau didn't happen. He still had no trust in God, and he moves towards a greater evil than his own brother, and takes up residence next to this Gentile city, and it results in the rape of his daughter, and it results in his two sons, Levi and Simeon, committing a genocide and becoming worse than the people who had raped their sister by enslaving their children and their wives and taking all of their things and murdering them. And you would think that when all of this happens, Jacob would go, oh, what have I done? This is wrong, my sons. You think he would punish his sons. You think he would say, look, I know for a long, long time I have compromised and made poor decisions. That stops here because I see what I have taught you by how I am living my life. But instead, and Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. Jacob's response to God proving you can trust in me, Jacob's response to his lack of faith resulting in the rape of his daughter, and the mass murdering of other people and enslavement of people by his own children. His response, his great revelation, his great realization, his biggest priority and concern is, what have you done? Now everybody's not gonna like me, and they're gonna try to kill me. Jacob doesn't go, oh my sons, you've sinned against God, you've murdered innocent people, you've done great evil. What have you done? Jacob's response to his sons is not, I failed you as a father. If this is what you've learned from me to do, when instead of trusting in God to try to do it your way and to try to bring about vengeance in your own way. None of that is Jacob's response. Jacob's response is the same selfish nonsense Jacob has always said of, well, great, now guess what kind of problem you're going to cause me because you've done this. And they said unto their father, should he deal with our sister as with an harlot? And their response to Jacob is, you know what, Dad? What he did to our sister was evil, and we knew you weren't going to do anything about it anyway. Jacob's lack of faith, Jacob's compromising life, leads to his sons justifying in their mind a greater evil they had committed because they knew their father would have done nothing about the situation. Friends, the reason that sometimes God does things like pop a hip joint is because that was a lesser thing that could be done, okay? Because it was better that Jacob have a limp for the rest of his life and learn the lesson to not be self-reliant on himself, but instead trust in God. It was better for Jacob to learn that lesson then and there and to follow and serve God than it was for Jacob to not learn that lesson and everything that happens here happen. You and I don't understand that trusting in God not only is just an intelligent thing to do because you don't know the future and you don't know what's going to happen, but trusting in God is an important thing to do because of the fact that God knows the kinds of decisions we will make if we do not trust in Him. There are probably so many times, even in my own life, that because I trusted in God instead of doing my own thing, that God probably prevented me from ending up in a place where Jacob is right now, with the situations that Jacob is facing right now, with his son's evil decisions and his daughter's defilement. Friends, trusting in God is not just about giving God His way, because He's a big bully and He needs to be adored and loved on at all times and you have to just pay attention to Him. God teaching you to trust in Him is because God knows what's going to happen if you don't. And if Jacob had trusted in God and gone to Seir, gone to Bethel, gone to where he was supposed to go, back to his home, none of this ever would have happened. But instead, Jacob chose to trust in Jacob. And Jacob deciding to trust in Jacob leads to the horrible atrocities that happen in this chapter. As you're going about your week this week, I beg you, implore you, trust in God and let God handle the decisions of your life. I'm not saying don't use your logic. God gave you your logic, okay? But what I'm saying is that in situations you cannot control, don't worry, don't manipulate, don't deceive, don't sin to try and get yourself out of them, because the situations you can't control, God can and will if you will but trust in Him. So, that has been Genesis chapter 33 and 34. Had to make the executive decision to put these two together. There was just no way to do them separately. I mean, we could have, but it doesn't give you the full picture as when you put both of them together. Of course, this week, Genesis 35, 36, and 37 will be out. 35 and 36 will be out by the end of this day, today. And 37 will be out this coming Friday. That'll put us back in the same track as where we were. To remind all of you again, once we get to the end of Genesis, we're going to take a break from our book-by-book, chapter-by-chapter. Not that we're not coming back to that. We are, because that's extraordinarily important. I think there's a lot of passages in the Bible, especially through the Old Testament, that many people have never heard preached, never heard taught, never heard nothing about. So we're going to come back to that, and we are going to fulfill that. But given a lot of things that have happened over the last few months in our world and our country and things of that nature, the horrible lack of biblical knowledge that God's people have today, especially about very, very important things, things that are the difference between believing in God and not believing God, things that actually make people say, no, there cannot be a God if this is true, and walk away. We are going to heavily address those kinds of situations once we get through Genesis. It probably isn't going to happen until the beginning of next year, if I'm looking at the weeks correctly and how much time we have left and how much we're going to be going through on Genesis, but that is what is coming. So hope everyone has an excellent week. Hope that you gain something out of this, that you will leave here ready to trust God better, to make your life better as always. I hope to see you here very soon in Genesis chapter 35. You guys get out of here and go study.